You are listening to Arrive by The Cycling Podcast, supported by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Or Matty Morich with a daredevil descent off the Poggio. There are my two selections, I think. I'll go with those.
That's a very good shout, I think. Yeah.
Well, welcome to the first episode of Arrive, our instant reflections on the first monument of the season, Milan-San Remo. And we opened there with a little clip from our preview episode. Now, a lot of you have requested no spoilers in the titles to these episodes, but I'm not sure what we can do about spoilers in our preview episodes, chaps, because they're... I think it was me tipping Matty Morich for the win.
Even a blind squirrel finds a nut every now and then, every few years. Even a broken watch gets the time right twice a day.
From buffalo to blind squirrel. I mean, Lionel was quick to see the sense in that. Daniel suspiciously quiet over there in Berlin. And I interpret his silence as he thought Matty Morich had no chance of winning Milan-San Remo. But we have... Now, Daniel... Let's kick this off because this is going to be a punchy episode. You called this the best 10 minutes of the cycling season. Do you think we saw just now, half an hour or so ago, the best 10 minutes of the cycling season so far, at least?
The 10 minutes was slightly inaccurate. It's more like 15 or 20, isn't it? I suppose. I'm just thinking it's 9.8 kilometers to go when the Poggio starts, which took...
Feels like 10 minutes.
Taken them about 14, 15 minutes, I guess. 16 minutes, maybe. But yes, it was absolutely electrifying. More so than your average Milan-San Remo, wasn't it? Because of what had come before. You know, we had been told to expect something special from Tadej Pogacar, a surprise, or at least... something that wasn't particularly unexpected, but perhaps unconventional, unorthodox. And that's what we got from UAE, an onslaught on the Cipressa, which really conditioned the rest of the race, didn't it?
Did they also, was the onslaught also at their own expense to some extent? Because they seemed slightly undermanned, and there was a moment where Pogacar seemed to be looking around for teammates. I mean, you know, he didn't win in the end, so we can be critical of their tactics, but... Jan Palance did a lot of heavy lifting, then Davide Formolo and Diego Ulisi in the end. But might he have expected a bit more firepower on the Cipressa in particular?
I don't think you could really expect them to do any more damage than they did. I mean, it was pretty unprecedented. I mean, Lionel, I don't know what you thought, but I certainly don't remember a San Remo where the group has been that small going over the Cipressa. And not only... was it only 30 riders or so, but not many riders came back on the straight road between the Cipressa and the Poggio. So it was a clean cut. And I think they knew that Pogacar's only chance was the attack on the Poggio. They didn't really have a second card. So, you know, I think the point you make, Rich, is definitely true, but of other riders, of the all of the quick riders, the Van Aerts and the Pedersens, and even to a certain extent Van der Poels, they were the ones who needed more teammates and... certainly a teammate on the other side of the Poggio. And my key thesis of this podcast is going to be that Primoz Roglic cost Wout van Aert Milan-San Remo. Well, Primoz Roglic's absence on the other side of the Poggio is what really costs Wout van Aert.
And perhaps the GP Denain on Thursday cost Primoz Roglic because he made quite a big effort then. Lionel, have you got a kind of summary of the race?
The summary of the monument. Yeah, we haven't really come up with a tale of the etape equivalent, have we? But I have, Richard, because, well, the first three quarters of the race was pretty much completely uneventful. But I was left with a couple of takeaways. In the preview episode we released in the week, I described Milan-San Remo as a how done it rather than a who done it. And I'm sort of images of Matej Mohoric as Professor Plum in the library. It was Mohoric on the descent of the Poggio with the carbon fibre piping. He is the Slovenian champion, of course, keeps up Slovenia's run of wins in World Tour races. The other thought was...
He won ahead of Colonel Mustard, didn't he? the flying lemon meringue pie, as he's now dubbed. Anyway, we'll get on to that.
Colonel Mustard?
No, it's Anthony Turgis, I thought.
Oh, okay. Anyway. Yeah, of course. Very inconsiderate of the Milan-San Remo organisers to schedule the race so it clashed with Pogacar's interval session, his four attacks on the Poggio quick succession.
I heard four. I counted six. I've just watched it back, and I counted six. Well, certainly six.
Four proper ones.
Well, four when he was the rider who launched the attack, but six if you include the two when he went after riders who were attacking and there was a bit of a gap behind.
But that's not an attack, is it? That's a reaction.
Well, anyway. I mean, six distinct accelerations. There'll be six bumps in his power file.
True. Well, let's just recap the race as it unfolded then. The pre-race story was really all about the absentees, wasn't it? No Julian Alaphilippe or Jasper Stuyven, no Sonny Colbrelli, Caleb Ewan, Sam Bennett, Vincenzo Nibali, lots of big names missing, almost all of them because of illness. But one notable return, starting his first race of the season, to the surprise of pretty much everybody, including people at Canyon, the bike suppliers for Alpecin Phoenix, who I was speaking to last week. Matthew van der Poel started the race, his first race of the season, coming back from injury, of course, from last season. Milan-San Remo, 293 kilometres long, and the break went in kilometre zero, kilometre one, really, technically.
Did van der Poel's reappearance qualify for the James Brown analogy, the please, please, please award? Maybe that's a new award. Do you know, it did remind me a little bit, much less spectacular, much less shocking, but it reminded me a little bit of Marco Pantani reappearing, resurfacing miraculously for the 2000 Giro when it was starting from the Vatican, having been missing for months before that.
It was a bit like, I don't know, Prince turning up halfway through a James Brown concert just to kind of wow everybody. I don't know. Anyway, as I say, the break went right at the start. There were two riders from Astana, Yevgeny Gidic and Artyom Zakharov, Lotto Soudal's Filippo Conca, Filippo Taliani and Riccardo Zurita of Drone Hopper, Diego Sevilla and Samuele Vivi of Iolo, and Alessandro Tonelli of Bardiani. And they were away all day. The gap never went much beyond 7 minutes. It hovered between 5 and 7 minutes all day. Back in the bunch, Jos van Emden of Jumbo-Visma was doing the Tim de Klerk role, wasn't he, with a bit of help from Jacopo Mosca of Trek at times. But it was van Emden riding extremely strongly just to keep that break in check. And we didn't really see anything of significance happen until the Capo Berta, which was the last of the three climbs before the Cipressa. That's when Tom Pidcock of Ineos was dropped. He hasn't raced since Kerner-Brussels-Kerner and was ill before Strada Bianchi, so perhaps not such a surprise. And then just before the Cipressa, is there a worse place to have a mechanical problem? Peter Sagan, the chain got jammed. There seemed to be some problem with the chain looping underneath the jockey wheels beneath his rear derailleur, and that was pretty much the end of his chances. On the Cipressa, Rivi and Tonelli were the two men in the lead. UAE and Jumbo Visma were the teams on the front of the bunch. Elia Viviani and Fabio Jakobsen were dropped. As you said, Polansch and Formolo of UAE set a really strong pace, and it was that which did the damage. The group was whittled down to about 30-ish. Tonelli and Rivi did lead onto the Poggio, but were caught immediately. Then we saw Pogacar's interval session of between 4 and 6 attacks / accelerations, depending on your definition. There was quite a critical crash midway down the bunch going round a corner as they went up the Poggio, which split that group into two. And shortly after that, Soren Kraut Andersen of DSM forced really the decisive move. Pogacar, Wout van Aert, Matthew van der Poel responded to that. But it was Matej Mohoric, the Slovenian champion, who got across to them as they went over the top of the Poggio and down the very beginning of the descent. There was that hairy moment where he had to bunny hop himself back onto the road when it looked like he looked down or took his eyes off the road a bit. And then on the run-in, he had another hairy moment. His chain appeared to slip and certainly missed a few pedal
revs. And he had
revs.
Another one on the descent as well, a second one on the descent where an uneven bit of the road seemed to throw his bike, and he again left the road and came back on. It was hair-raising.
But he got into the final 500 metres and pretty much had it then, despite a very spirited move by Anthony Turgis, who was, making up for the fact that his teammate Peter Sagan was not there. Matthew van der Poel, an incredible third place in his first race of the season. But as you say, Daniel, it was a humdinger of the last 18 and a half minutes.
And, I mean, you haven't mentioned the dropper seat post that Matti Mohoric used, which he revealed in his post-race interview. Obviously, mountain biking technology there, allowing him to just take the descent, a bit more safely, supposedly, and more comfortably. A risk, though. He's obviously tried it a lot in training, but, you wouldn't want it to be stuck down and him come to the finish looking like he's on a bike three sizes too small for him. I actually, watching the descent again of the Poggio, it's really fascinating to watch it. This is always a really interesting race to watch with hindsight, knowing the result, because to watch what Mohoric did on the climb and, always trying to hide, to be there, but not be making the kinds of accelerations that Pogacar and others were making all the way up, remember. He then bridged across over the top and went to the front and attacked on the descent. Now Pogacar was a length or so behind him when he left the road for the first time, and it was at that moment that the gap actually opened, because I think Pogacar got frightened. I think he thought that Mohoric was taking too many risks, that he might well take himself out of the race. But you can see on the replay that Pogacar, eases off in response to Mohoric leaving the road and bunny hopping back on. I think that was the moment where he got the gap that he managed to hold.
Yes, Rich. I mean, part of me thinks that, this will go down as a Milan-San Remo that was won on the descent of the Poggio, like Sean Kelly's in 1992, Moser in 1980.
I'm sure Sean Kelly also used the dropper post, no?
In 1984, Moser won in a similar way. But I almost don't think that where he went really mattered. I think what was absolutely key was the composition of the group. And you got this scenario again, and it's just becoming such a weird race, Milan-San Remo, in that, we say it's not for sprinters anymore, but subsequent to that sort of collective attack by UAE over the Cipressa, it was mainly fast guys in that bunch of 20 riders. It wasn't 25 climbers. It was mainly guys like Mads Pedersen, Giacomo Nizzolo, Gamet of Intermarché, and riders of that ilk. And then, you always get this situation on the other side of the Poggio when people start looking at each other, and they're always vulnerable then to the attack. We talked about Ganna maybe doing it. We talked in the podcast the other day about sort of Cancellara having done it years ago, and it's always something that can happen if people start looking at each other, and that is always likely when there are fast riders, which there were a whole glut of riders who sort of would have fancied themselves in a sprint, but were also scared of other riders in that bunch. And that's where one of them needed a teammate, and none of them had a teammate at all. But I almost think that Mohoric, descending is his sort of superpower. And in fact, he's shown it before in Milan-San Remo. He's got a really good record in that race, or has over the last few years, and has shown it on the descent of the Poggio. But he almost could have gone at the bottom of the descent, because I think that the hesitation may well have been the same.
Yeah, I mean, Mohoric should be remembered. He missed Tirreno Adriatico because he crashed in Strade Bianche a couple of weeks ago. And the other superpower is that he's very good in long races. Six of his eight World Tour race wins have been in long races of over 200 kilometres. Even his Vuelta stage win in 2017 was 207k, which is long by Vuelta standards. His Giro stage win was 244 kilometres. And of course, last year in the Tour de France, he won the two longest stages, one of which was the one to Le Cruzo, 249 kilometres. So, yeah, fast at the end of long attritional races. And as you say, he did keep himself out of sight a bit, but you could see him sort of 15, 20 back, just always coming round people, moving up, making sure he's in the right place. And he did have a couple of very helpful riders, teammates with him. Damiano Caruso was there very late on, and Jan Tratnik as well, who, Richard, you also mentioned in the preview episode. He didn't go for his long solo
next
ride.
Year.
for next year, we'll go from, you'll go from probably the outskirts of Milan, maybe. But no, it was a well put together move. It was an all or nothing one, and that's what we talked about last week, isn't it? It's basically one key move will always trump that kind of repeated effort by Pogacar. I'm sure he was hoping he might pull a little group away, but oddly, because the group was 30 and then 15, there was much more incentive for everyone to kind of close up and keep it all back together. Whereas if that had been maybe 100 riders, you might have seen more of a sort of front end split of sort of six or seven, and then Pogacar would have had something smaller to work with. So in a funny way, the smaller group may well have worked against Pogacar's moves.
I also thought coming into the bottom of the podio that that small group really was to the benefit of Matthew van der Poel, because remember last year, he does struggle for position sometimes, and he was well out of position last year when they began the Poggio. The small group allowed him to be where he needed to be. It also occurred to me watching Mohoric that, you know, it's less than a year since the UCI banned the super tuck position, that he, you know, he kind of pioneered those positions, may not have been the first, but it seemed to be a key part of his descending skill, the extreme positions. That's been banned, and yet it doesn't seem to matter. He has adapted, and his descending skill hasn't been sort of decapitated by that rule. He's responded, and he's still a lethal weapon on the descents. But you know, he does also have some terrible crashes as well, doesn't he? Like, I mean, Nibali's famous for his descending, but also his terrible crashes.
Yeah, we've said this many times, haven't we? It's a characteristic of the really good fast descenders. And you know, I've said on numerous occasions that we talked about the ability to correct mistakes, and I felt that was a massive hallmark of Peter Sagan's descending when he was at his best in the Tour de France. You know, going downhill, that you would often see him, you know, three, four times on a descent, he would take the wrong line, but he would correct it. And we saw that from Mohoric today, didn't we? There were at least two or three corners that he took the wrong line on. And you know, you talk about crashes, Rich. I mean, last year he had one of the worst that I can remember, or one of the most spectacular that I can remember, the Giro in the stage to Campo Felice. And well, he pulled out of that race, but he'd actually wanted to continue, you know, almost seconds after getting back on his bike and having landed on his head. And yeah, he's managed throughout the course of his career, you know, despite the few crashes that he's had, not to lose any of that edge.
I think one thing that should be said about the descent and the run-in is just how close the motorbikes were on the descent. Not just the camera bike, but there were a couple of bikes in front of Mohoric, weren't there, on the way down. Nothing he can do about that. It's not his responsibility.
Apart from get as close as possible.
Well, other than to get as close as possible. But I mean, talking to riders from yesteryear, you know, and the skill of descending in general, they do take a lead from the line the motorbikes take, and they know instinctively, you know, how much they can push things. And obviously the motorbike is providing a bit of shelter. And I do think, I mean, this is just a real sort of knee-jerk reaction to it, but it is something that does seem to blight the Italian races a little bit more. You know, the Belgian races have clusters of motorbikes, but the Italian races, the Giro, you often see the motorbike incredibly close to the front of the peloton.
It's funny, Lionel, I was watching Italian Eurosport the other day, and they were saying, talk about pot calling kettle black, the Italian commentators were talking about Belgian races being particularly susceptible and particularly bad for this. But I mean, I think you're definitely right, but to complain about the motorbikes in Milan-San Remo in 2022 when you've seen what it was like in sort of the mid-90s or the 80s, I mean, just go and look on YouTube at some of those editions. I mean, there was a whole sort of phalanx of motorbikes, and it's almost part of the charm, part of the kind of wiles of Milan-San Remo. In fact, on our Spanish sister podcast the other day, Pedro Jorillo, the former Mappe rider, told a story about Paolo Bettini explaining to the rest of his team when before he won in 2003, that he was going to attack in a specific point, not because that was the best place to attack, but because that was where the motorbikes tended to congregate, the the motorbikes tended to slow down to get the best picture, because it was a particularly scenic, particularly photogenic point on the Poggio. And, you know, I've talked a lot, and I talked in this episode about the spot on the Poggio where attacks have always gone. And, you know, based on this story, it almost sounded as though that spot became such the ideal point at which to launch an attack because of the motorbikes, because the motorbikes thought it was a great picture from there.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science. This is Arrive by the Cycling Podcast, supported by MAP.
A huge thanks to our longtime sponsor, Science and Sport, for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. For 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and use the code SISCP25 at the checkout. And a big thank you to MAP, who have come on board with the Cycling Podcast this year. And thanks to their support that we are able to do things like this, bring you a new spin-off show, Arrive, which will be coming out following at least all the monuments. And well, we'll see how it goes, see how you like it. Tell us what you think. Email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and go and have a look at MAP's beautiful clothing at map.cc. Well, chaps, Milan-San Remo is a fascinating race, isn't it? It does kind of all boil down to, well, Cipressa and Poggio and the descent of the Poggio. But you were commenting, Daniel, that the composition of the lead group is a curious mix of talents, isn't it, with sprinters and Grand Tour winners and classic specialists. And we've said it before, but it's one of the only races in the year when you see all those guys kind of slugging it out together. I mean, that's a trend that you think has accelerated, or something has changed in the way that Milan-San Remo is contested?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it the other day, didn't we? The switch to seven-man teams, I think it was 2018, was the first edition. How, I think, you know, that change was made across the board of World Tour races, one rider fewer in Grand Tours as well, so it went down to eight. But I think of all the races on the calendar, Milan-San Remo is maybe the one that's been affected the most by that. And, you know, it's really not comparable to any other classic or any other one day race when you again look at the sort of constellation of riders that are left at the end. Riders who, you know, their very nature, if you apply it to other races, is such that, you know, you expect them to be surrounded by a gaggle of domestiques or a lead out train, and yet they're all left on their own at the end of Milan-San Remo. And it kind of makes you wonder what exactly is the physiological profile of the perfect Milan-San Remo rider nowadays. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, Tadej Pogacar, who, okay, is kind of outside of, well, every other Venn diagram that really applies to professional cycling at the moment. He can do pretty much everything. So riders like that, the best Grand Tour riders of the day, can still be in contention. But, you know, I just look at the top 15 and I'm sort of left scratching my head. I find it quite baffling.
Like a bunch of random names, yeah, just put together. It's some good cyclists gathered together. Lionel, what did you make of Pogacar? And, you know, the strategy was obvious, make it really hard on the Cipressa and try and set something up for the Poggio. There have been rumours the last couple of days that Pogacar has been suffering from a cold as well, so we thought he might not be at his best, but he didn't look under par. It's just the Poggio is a fascinating climb that isn't quite hard enough for him to carve out that difference to achieve that clean cut that Daniel mentioned. And that's what makes it so interesting, isn't it? And so intriguing and entertaining.
It is, absolutely. And I think that the absence of Julian Alaphilippe, perhaps, and I don't know about Jasper Stuyven, but certainly Alaphilippe, somebody to riff with Pogacar, that was the missing ingredient, really, wasn't it? Because when Pogacar went, somebody reacted. The second or the third of, well, I'm struggling now because Daniel's messed with my definition of the moves, but the one that...
I noted down, first one was 8.2 kilometres ago, then 7.8, then 7.4, then 7.2, then 6.6, then 6.4.
Yeah, there's two of those that I'm counting as reactions rather than accelerations. There was the one that Wout van Aert reacted to first, wasn't there? And then Van der Poel rode across. And then had, you know, they been able to cooperate. And as I say, had the gap behind the group behind been that much bigger, there might have been less incentive to close up. But it was a sort of worth, if we don't close up now, that could be gone. So that brought that one back together. The second of the big moves that Pogacar made, I think it was Aramburu of Movistar who reacted, wasn't it? And you know, that didn't look strong enough to do anything. But what it was missing was the next move over the top. And as I say, Alaphilippe would have been as aggressive, or certainly would have been interested in trying to force something away. And as you say, the problem for the sprinters is they are left with only their one card to play, which is to hope it comes down to a sprint and hope that their legs are fast enough. They're not going to risk chasing something down or, you know, making a move themselves unless they can be certain that it will stick. And no one can be certain of anything sticking until the one move that Mohoric made obviously did. But I think that the absence of anyone willing to sort of go into tandem with Pogacar was what meant that it was always going to sort of come down to something happening on the descent.
All chaps, I mean, the lack of a willing co-conspirator, or, you know, I talked the other day about overcomplicating things at Milan-San Remo, and they, you know, we've already said they did one very novel thing, UAE, by making the race so hard on the Cipressa. They also did another novel thing, or Pogacar did, by attacking in an unusual place on the Poggio, right at the bottom. You know, would he have been better served to just throw the kitchen sink at it on the traditional spot, you know, a kilometre before the summit, where the winning moves have always gone on the Poggio?
He really telegraphed it as well, didn't he? He's on the drops the whole way up the Poggio, and I saw him on the drops just as Ulissi, I think, went to the front at the foot of the Poggio, and I thought, it's coming any second now. I mean, in the end, we talked the other day, and we saw it last year with Stuyven, maybe to some extent with Moritz this year as well, that as we're looking at all the real kind of A-listers, the Van Aerts, Van der Poels and Pogacars, Moritz slips away, and the other guys that made a real difference, Søren Kragh Andersen, you know, that attack by him in the traditional place was, it looked like it had been rehearsed and was planned. We saw him last year as well, of course, bridge up to Jasper Stuyven, and was the forgotten man of that Milan-San Remo. It was probably thanks to him that Stuyven won last year. And again, Kragh Andersen, a really crucial role this year.
It's those wild cards, Rich. As you say, Stuyven last year, Mohoric to a certain extent this year, Søren Kragh Andersen again today, where there's just 3 or 4 seconds of, shall we, shouldn't we chase him? My energies might be better served chasing a Van Aert or a Pogacar than a Søren Kragh Andersen. And they're the guys that have tended to break the elastic.
Just following up on what you said earlier, Daniel, Roglic, I mean, Christoph Laporte as well was somebody who might have fancied hanging on to that group. And had they been able to help Van Aert down the other side, that might have made a real difference, because Van Aert would have fancied his chances in the sprint. Although I'm sure Van der Poel, who in the end was third and did win that sprint, might have given him a very close run. But what did you feel Roglic in particular did wrong?
I look back at the footage, and he was, you know, ostensibly on the back of the group that went over the Poggio, behind it was Pogacar, Søren Kragh Andersen, and then slightly further back was Van der Poel and Van Aert, and then it was, I think it was only 2 or 3 seconds, then a group of about 10 riders followed, and Roglic was sort of safely in that group. But things happen so quickly from that point that it's actually pretty hard to move up. And okay, it's a wide road when they get down off the descent onto the Aurelia in San Remo, and you've got the room to move up. But if you're, by that point, you might be, you know, 200 meters from the where you need to be at the front to start making the pace and to tow your sprinter, your fast guy, back before that hesitation kicks in. So I just thought that was probably key. That was probably fatal for Van Aert. I mean, I see he's saying, there are already quotes from him saying that Van der Poel and Van Aert Well, he felt they rode for the victory and others rode for the podium. I think that's possibly a little bit harsh. I mean, on the issue of not having a teammate, when I think of the sort of perfect guy to do this, and people might sneer because of, you know, the period of cycling in which it took place and what we know about his career. But a George Hincapie, what George Hincapie did for Mark Cavendish in 2008, I think that's the kind of perfect prototype of the rider to, you know, move up and drag a sprinter or just set the pace for a sprinter in those key last 2 kilometers. But, you know, am I oversimplifying things, being unfair, being harsh in sort of scratching my head at why this position, this role isn't being covered by the strongest teams?
Because quick corrections, it's not. Corner, it was 2009.
Sorry, 2009. Yeah.
Just before I make a point on that, I mean, Roglic was the only one who made a kind of an attempt at a kind of conventional counter-attack, really, wasn't it, to one of Pogacar's moves. I think the third of Pogacar's actual moves. And I suppose, picking up on what you just said, Daniel, about Pogacar going in all the wrong places, probably the ideal place would have been where Søren Krogh Andersen went. I mean, that would have been the sweet spot, I suppose, but Krogh Andersen got there first and Pogacar had, sort of burned his legs with an earlier effort. In terms of the sprinters, I mean, who had someone up there? I think Israel Premier Tech had Chris Nylund in there with Giacomo Nizzola, but they were in the second half of that group. Arnaud Démare was on his own, I think, until Pascher was in there till quite late, wasn't he, I think?
I think the first 14 positions were filled by riders from 14 different teams.
Yeah. So it's there's no one there, is there, to do that job, to do that work of closing gaps.
Seems strange.
Well, do you think they just thought we won't bother doing that, or do you think it was hard?
It's strange that a team like Groupama FDJ, for example, that the only rider in their team who can get over the Poggio in that front group is Arnaud Démare. That does seem odd, doesn't it?
Yeah,
really. Which I think is the point Daniel's making.
Yeah, I mean, it's in an average race. Any kind of race, if you said there were, you know, in the top 14 positions, you would expect one of the strongest teams in the peloton, Jumbo Visma, UAE or Ineos, to have 2 or 3 or one of the other teams. But
I made the comment earlier about Roglic. I was at the GP de Dinant on just Thursday, 48 hours ago, a tough race over 200 kilometers over lots of cobbles and climbs, and Roglic was up there riding hard. And I think the team had made the decision ultimately that trying him out in the cobbles ahead of the Tour de France stage on the cobbles was slightly more important than keeping him fresh for Milan San Remo. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if the edge was taken off Roglic's performance today. And that might be a decision that they regret, because Roglic could have been a really important rider in the finale for Wout van Aert.
As you said, Daniel, I mean, the unusual thing isn't just that the group was so small on and after the Cipressa, around just under 30 riders, wasn't it? The surprising thing was that it didn't come back. You know, there was a big group behind, and the gap on the finish line was not huge. It was only a minute and 15 seconds, and then, another group, little group, perhaps inside a couple of minutes. It's the fact that it didn't all come back together again between the Cipressa and the Poggio, which we have seen happen before, haven't we? We've seen significant splits on the Cipressa, but the conventional thing is that it comes back together. Perhaps it's
although you could argue that at least 14 teams with their best riders were represented in that front group. So who was going to bring it back?
Quite.
I mean, I think this is, again, we're probably not qualified to really delve very deep into this, but this is one race where perhaps more than all other of the classics, at least, we see the influence of aerodynamics as well. And you know, we see what quantum leaps have taken place in aerodynamics over the last few years or decade or so. You know, you look at the average speed of the winner, 45.3 kilometers an hour, and you know, the faster a race goes, the bigger gaps are going to be, and the more sort of differences in ability, difference in watts, are going to be accentuated. And you know, as you say, Lionel, that second group not coming back, I think it's probably partly a result of that.
My main relief, I mean, is that Matty Moritz's dropper seat post didn't malfunction, and we were, you know, exposed to the sight of him trying to hang on with his knees round his ears as he was pedalling on a child's bike to the finish. That didn't happen, but I'm sure we'll see dropper seat posts employed by more riders. I'd also be curious to know what kind of gear he had on his bike, because his legs were moving very slowly as while he was going very quickly. So, you know, he said at the end, didn't he, that he'd prepared for this all winter and thought about it a lot.
His legs were moving so slowly, I thought he'd bonked coming into the last kilometre. He looked as though he was about to get off.
Well, yeah. Well, listen, chap, should we leave it there? Because the idea with these episodes of Arrivé is they're going to be short and punchy, and there'll be more Milan San Remo chat, I'm sure, in the normal midweek episode, because this episode is an addition to the weekly episode, which will be coming out sometime around midweek.
Any flops in our hot takes? I mean, I had a few bets, which none of which came in for me.
Filippo Ganna.
I had Arnaud Démare, actually, and I was very hopeful about him at one stage because he was right up there over the Cipressa. I had him, I had Stibar, didn't really see him much at all. Søren Kragh Andersen as well.
Démare is clearly in great condition, isn't he? But he's just lacking something in the big bunch sprints. But the fact that he was there today suggests he's in great condition. I was confused when I saw Sagan drop back with a mechanical problem and his team remain at the front. Well, now we know they were working for Anthony Turgis, maybe, who we haven't really mentioned at all, but second today, he's been sort of hinting at a major result in one of these races, hasn't he? But that's the best he's managed, and just reward, I guess, for the criminally underrated.
Well, and everyone in that team keeps raving about the influence of Peter Sagan, and particularly the sponsors that Peter Sagan has brought in. I've hardly read an interview with a Total Energy rider this year in which they've not mentioned how good their bikes are and how good their clothing is. But the main beneficiaries, or the only beneficiaries at the moment, do not seem to be Peter Sagan.
Second in Milan-San Remo today, fourth in the Tour of Flanders in the past, Turgis. That big win is coming, Daniel. Don't worry. It will be Paris-Roubaix, maybe.
And then he'll be criminally overrated after that. Listen, shall we leave it there, chaps?
I was just going to say very quickly, sorry, Ganna apparently was under the weather as well. And I think, you know, in picking out people who didn't perform, clearly the flu that swept through the peloton in Paris-Nice, but also perhaps, you know, riders picking up, you know, colds and flu and what have you. It's been a fairly chilly spring, hasn't it? So I don't know whether
even you're battling through a head cold, Lionel.
I am, Richard. Yeah, I nearly didn't make Milan San Remo today, but I watched every single minute of it today. So you two didn't have to.
Fabulous effort from your sick bed. Well, listen, we'll be back with Arrivé in a couple of weeks after the Tour of Flanders, I would guess. Email us. Let us know what you think. If you have any suggestions, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And we'll be back midweek. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.